Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Francine Foss, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Foss is a professor of medicine in the section of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. And Dr. Gore is director of hematological malignancies at Smilow. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can submit questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, you'll hear a conversation about head and neck cancers with Dr. Barbara Burtness. Dr. Burtness is a professor of medical oncology and clinical research program leader for the head and neck cancer program. Here's Stephen Gore.
So this is a return to Yale for you, is that right?
That's correct. I trained at Yale in internal medicine. I returned after my fellowship and was here on the faculty for about 13 years. And I left for Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia in 2005. And now I'm back.
Wow. And lucky for us, what was it that made you want to come back? What's the new mission here for you?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that there's been such an explosive growth of research and clinical research and genomic research and recruitment of fabulous new people to the Cancer Center. So it seemed like it would be one of the most exciting places in the country to work. And the mission is to make huge strides in our treatment of head and neck cancer.
Great. And how long have you been here now? Again, the second time?
2 months.
Oh, 2 months. So you're a newbie. I'm feeling like the old man of the mountain having arrived here November 1st. So pretty soon we'll be having you host the radio show. So
excellent.
So tell us about head and neck cancer. That seems like there's a lot of parts of the head and neck, right? I mean, what are we thinking about here?
Yeah. So there are a lot of parts of the head and neck, and they aren't all exactly the same. When we speak about head and neck cancer, what we're referring to are cancers that arise anywhere sort of from the sinuses and the nose down to the top of the esophagus. So common cancers in those body parts are nasopharynx cancer, which is a virally associated cancer that's very common in East Asia, for example. Smoking-related cancers like voice box cancer and tongue cancer. And now we are seeing a dramatic rise in the numbers of tonsil and base of tongue cancers that we see. And those arise because of exposure to human papillomavirus.
Okay, well I certainly want to talk about that in a little bit. So are all these cancers treated the same?
No, they're not. That's one of the things that makes this a really interesting field to work in.
Okay.
There's a lot of nuance. Some areas, surgery is, can be done without horrible functional consequences and is highly curative. In other areas, the surgery might be equally curative, but the functional consequences of removing a person's entire tongue, for example, are such that we look for non-surgical ways to cure some of these cancers.
Yeah, no, I think that many of us have known people or seen people who've had surgeries for these kinds of cancers that, you know, are frankly somewhat disfiguring. And the good news is I've got a friend in Baltimore who's lived this way for many years, and he functions just fine. But it would seem to me that you'd really want to be able to do as much preservation of the anatomy as you can. How does one approach that?
So let me first say that surgery has made huge strides also. So we now have minimally invasive transoral surgeries that can remove smaller tumors in the tonsil or the base of the tongue. And there's also been huge progress in reconstruction. So the use of new materials like Alloderm, the use of free tissue transfer. We have a marvelous reconstructive surgeon here at Yale. So if you do need to do one of the big surgeries that in the past would have been terribly deforming, the results now are actually much better than they were in the past. However, many head and neck cancers are very responsive to radiation. And so the what we call the organ preservation strategy has long been to look at using radiation in combination either with chemotherapy or with a biologic treatment like cetuximab, and doing that to curatively treat the area where the tumor is without having to do the large operation.
Hmm. So is the goal no longer to sort of take out all the cancer surgically? That seems to be what I remember when I was a medical student.
So you start with a very careful assessment of, can you do that? Are you likely to get clear margins? Is it likely that the operation that you're planning really would get everything out? And then if it got everything out, what would that mean for the patient in terms of functional impairment, the nature of the reconstructive surgery, the how much rehab is involved to get back to speaking and swallowing normally? And if the consensus is either that the operation might not actually get all the way around the cancer, or that the functional outcome, even with reconstruction, might not be that good. In that case, then we think about using chemotherapy and radiation actually in place of surgery.
Oh, wow.
Once the patient's done with the chemo radiation, we do reassess them. Did it work? Is the tumor all gone in the wake of the radiation? It can take between 4 to 12 weeks to know that answer for sure. But if there's evidence that the cancer persists, the operation is then planned at that point. So you've attempted to avert it. I would say 90% of the time you do. Every once in a while, you do end up doing the surgery anyway.
And are some patients actually cured with the chemotherapy and radiation without surgery?
Oh, absolutely. The majority nowadays.
Well, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll want to talk more about that as well. Let's backtrack here. And how would I know that I had a head and neck cancer? Like, what would be my symptoms that would bring me to a physician's attention?
Well, so just as there are many subsites, there are many ways that these cancers can present. A common thing for a person with a tongue cancer might be a non-healing sore on the tongue. That might be a little bit painful. Or it might just be a thickening. Sometimes people don't really feel the mass, but they start to notice trouble swallowing or a thickening of their speech, that the speech isn't as clear as it was. People with voice box cancer might develop hoarseness or an inability to project if they were trying to speak loudly. People with the tonsil and base of tongue cancer, those tumors are small and they're in a sort of a forgiving part of the back of the throat. And many of those patients present not with the feeling where the primary tumor is, but they feel a mass in the neck. And that's a lymph node that started to expand because cancer cells have traveled to the lymph node. There's some symptoms that people develop that are so similar to things that we get normally that they can lead to a delay in diagnosis because people blow them off. So a little bit of nose bleeding can be the first sign of a nasopharynx cancer, or what seems to be chronic sinusitis. It might actually start in allergy season and just be slow to resolve because there's a mass at the back of the nose. Earaches. So it turns out that it's not normal for an adult to develop an ear infection. And there are a couple of other causes that are not related to cancer, but head and neck cancer is one of the most common causes of an earache in an adult.
Is the diagnosis usually made by people's primary care doctor, or what's been your experience there?
I think that there's much more awareness of the need to work up a neck mass in particular very carefully than there was even a few years ago. So what one would hope is that if a person went to their primary care doctor with a swollen lymph node in the neck and the doctor thought maybe it was from an infection and put them on antibiotics, that would not turn into many months of switching around the different antibiotics and so forth, which, you know, can happen. But ideally, if there's a mass in the neck, it would be sampled with a fine needle aspirate, which is a way of obtaining some cells to look at under the microscope without making an incision in the neck. We don't want an incision in the neck because many of these patients will need a lymph node dissection where we want to remove all of the lymph nodes together as a package, and anything that's been done surgically to change the lymph node drainage or change the anatomy in that area is not good. So hopefully what happens is the person has a fine needle aspirate and some kind of imaging test, either a CAT scan or an MRI. The lymph nodes that come up with these human papillomavirus-associated tonsil cancers tend to be very cystic. And earlier in the, I won't call it an epidemic, but there's certainly a lot more of this cancer than there was 10 or 15 years ago. Early in the period of the increase of these HPV-associated cancers, sometimes you would get a CT report calling these cystic masses branchial cleft cysts. And there has been a big effort to educate the community that new onset branchial cleft cysts are not seen in middle-aged people.
Is a branchial cleft cyst a serious thing somebody would worry about otherwise?
No, it's a benign developmental abnormality.
If there's something benign, that's an awful name.
Yeah.
Just for our listening audience, that sounds really scary.
Yeah, no, so it's a benign abnormality, but it's one that if you're going to have it, you should know by the time you're a kid. And so when a 50-year-old person comes in with a new mass in the neck, that's not the diagnosis. And so I think there's been a good improvement in the ability to make this diagnosis in recent years.
Yeah, I know, I think about 5 or 10 years ago, my dentist in Baltimore, and I happen to get my teeth cleaned 4 times a year because I'm a plaque former, but every time he does this oral cancer screen, and you know, I've always kind of felt like, okay, really, in the last 3 months or whatever, but I don't know, you know, in some ways it's a little reassuring too that somebody's looking out for it, I guess.
I do think that dentists are the only people really who look carefully in our mouths on a regular basis. And it's a good thing that they're trained to be responsive to things that aren't always teeth problems, but they might be the first person to see.
Yeah. That's interesting. So I'm fascinated by what you're talking about, these virally mediated cancers. And I think that, you know, our audience will probably be interested in that as well. Now, you're talking about this HPV virus. Is that the same virus that's involved with genital warts?
Yes, and with cervix cancer. And it's a virus many people have been exposed to. There are over 200 types of human papillomavirus, and there are several, particularly HPV 16 and 18, that are much more likely to lead to cancer than the others. And people are exposed to these viruses sexually, and if the tonsil becomes infected, in most people, the infection is cleared. But there are some people, and we have not yet really defined what's different about them, if it's a genetic difference, if it's related to the immune reaction they might have made to this virus when they were exposed to it previously. But in some people, the infection is not cleared and it can lead to cancer.
Hmm. Well, we're definitely going to want to talk more about this fascinating subject after the break. But right now, we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about head and neck cancer with Dr. Barbara Burtness.
Genetic testing can be useful for people with certain types of cancer that seem to run in their families. Genetic counseling is a process that includes collecting a detailed personal and family history, a risk assessment, and a discussion of genetic testing options. Only about 5 to 10% of all cancers are inherited, and genetic testing is not recommended for everyone. Resources for genetic counseling and testing are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center and at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. The Yale Cancer Center Cancer Genetic Counseling Program is a new frontier in the fight against cancer. The program provides genetic counseling and testing to people at increased risk for hereditary cancer and helps them to make informed medical decisions based on their own personal risk assessment. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Stephen Gore, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Barbara Burtness. We are discussing head and neck cancer. And Barbara, before the break, you were telling us about the human papillomaviruses and how they're involved with this tonsillar cancer, which I guess you said was increasing in frequency?
Yes, it's increasing in frequency by several percent per year. It's one of the cancers that's on the most dramatic rise.
Is that because the virus is more common, or change in sexual practices, or does anybody know?
So people have tracked the rise in these cancers has been steady beginning in the late 1960s. So that is a soft hint that maybe it's related to lifestyle changes. There are data that show that a larger number of partners or larger number of people that you've kissed are associated with a higher risk for this. Partners of women who've had abnormal pap smears might be more likely to have it. And there are many things we don't know about why it's on the rise.
And is there a gender predisposition to this cancer?
Yes. The gender predisposition is for men, and it's quite striking. So about 6 men get this cancer for every 1 woman.
Oh, wow. So I know for women, to prevent cervical cancer, it's now recommended that, I guess, young adolescents or pre-adolescents are receiving these vaccines against HPV. Is there anything like that to prevent the tonsillar cancers?
We believe that it's quite likely that the identical vaccines will protect people from tonsillar cancer. And it's now been recommended that boys as well as girls who are between the ages of 11 and about 20, I guess, should receive the vaccine. It's clearly going to prevent genital warts, prevent cervix cancer, and quite likely, I think, also prevent tonsil cancer.
So this is a cancer that we could hope may go away if our vaccination policies were applied rigorously.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, that's it's always good to have cancers we can get rid of by not letting them start in the first place. Does insurance pay for the vaccine? Do you know?
I believe that it does.
Yeah. I know we had my son vaccinated, but this was kind of early in the day, and there was question about whether they would or not. And, I was willing to pay anyway because it seemed so important. But I'm sure things have gotten a little better since then. At least I hope so. So what happens to the patients who get these cancers? I mean, is this another kind of surgically treated cancer like some of the other ones you were mentioning?
So the primary cancer is usually pretty small. The bulkier area is the lymph node metastasis in the neck. And there are data that stretch back about 15 years now, demonstrating that for these patients who are treated with chemo radiation, the cure rate is much higher than for the traditional tobacco and alcohol kind of associated cancers. So actually, the chance of dying of one of these cancers if you are treated with chemo radiation is only about a fifth of the chance of dying if you have a tobacco or alcohol-associated cancer. However, with the advances in surgery, there is now also the option for some patients, if the primary tumor is small enough, to have a transoral removal of the tumor, have a neck dissection, and then go on to receive hopefully radiation only without chemotherapy. And so an important part of the conversation when a patient comes in to see the multidisciplinary clinic and meets the medical oncologist and the radiation oncologist and the surgeon is to define whether the primary tumor is small enough and the nodes seem contained enough that minimally invasive surgery is the right way to go. Or if there's a hint that the surgery wouldn't get all the way around the tumor, or that the cancer has started to break through the capsule of the lymph nodes, then we prefer to go with chemotherapy and radiation. Now, given that the cure rates with our traditional treatments are so high for the HPV-associated cancers, and also given that we figured out how to give these treatments in patients who had the other kind of head and neck cancer, a question that's arisen in our research in the past several years is, are we actually over-treating some of the people who have HPV-associated cancers? And could we give them a lower dose of radiation and still cure them, but leave them with less side effects in the long run? And so we recently completed a study where people who had human papillomavirus-associated cancer received a few cycles of chemotherapy before they started their radiation. And we looked at their response to chemotherapy. And if they were somebody who got a clinical complete response to the chemotherapy, we assigned them to get to get a lower dose of radiation and also to get a biologic instead of chemotherapy.
What's a biologic?
A biologic is a medicine like cetuximab, which is an antibody rather than a straightforward DNA poisoning chemical. It targets something called the epidermal growth factor receptor, which is common in head and neck cancers, and it leads to less long-term toxicity when it's given with radiation.
Okay.
So in this study, what we found was that if you were a non-smoker and you had an HPV-associated cancer and you had had a complete response to your chemotherapy, the cure rate at 2 years appeared to be 96%, even with getting a two-week shorter course of radiation.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That's spectacular.
We thought it was very good. And so our goal is to really refine what's the least toxic chemo regimen we can use to pick out these patients, and then for non-smokers who have HPV-associated cancers, to try to do a larger study that can definitively prove that people don't really need 7 weeks of radiation anymore for that cancer.
Did you have a hard time getting patients to agree to being treated less? I mean, it seems so scary. If you know something works, why would, you know, it seems like going off the cliff, you know, to putting your, you know, neck on the line, so to speak, right?
Yeah, although if you think about their experience, you know, having the mask made and going to lie down on the radiation table every day, 5 days a week, the patients actually loved this concept. And when the study was done enrolling, there were still many people who were calling up to ask, you know, did we have enough data yet to do this off study? Where we had trouble actually was in the approval process. I think the medical community was extremely conservative when we first proposed this.
So I think I lost a piece in the step. So here I was at my dentist getting my quarterly oral exam. And now he's seeing something in my tonsil, right? And I'm assuming he's sending me to a surgeon. How do I get into one of these multidisciplinary things? Because, boy, I don't want to go to a surgeon who just wants to rip everything out and not talk to these other people like you and the radiation oncologist who might be able to do some more conservative surgery. How do we get into one of these multidisciplinary specialty clinics?
You call up. So I think, you know, many people may not have cancer at the front of their minds when they first feel something on their tongue or have an earache or feel a mass in the neck. And it is quite likely that many of these people might be going to a local ear, nose, and throat doctor. However, I think once the diagnosis of cancer is made, it's very rational to seek an opinion at a comprehensive cancer center where essentially all patients with this sort of diagnosis are seen by a multidisciplinary team where if the person's going to be treated here, they also meet our speech and swallowing experts. We set them up for evaluation before the treatment. We make sure that they get exercises that continue during the radiation to minimize any impairment to their swallowing. We make sure that there's good rehabilitation when they're done. We meet as a team on a regular basis to discuss all the cases, to review the pathology, to look at the x-rays. So I do think that if a person does have this diagnosis established, that it's an uncommon enough cancer that being treated by a team that sees a high volume of it makes a big difference.
Is it your experience that many private or local community head and neck surgeons will sort of routinely make a referral to this kind of a comprehensive clinic, or is this something patients really should be very proactive about if they're interested in getting that kind of care?
I think there are many ENT surgeons who understand the importance of high-volume surgery, high-volume radiation, multidisciplinary team. It's not everyone, though. And so what I would say directly to the patient is you are your own best advocate. If you have been told that you have a cancer, seek out the best possible care.
That's great advice. Now, you said that these cancers tend to be more curable than the routine tobacco and alcohol-related head and neck cancer. Is there anyone have any ideas why? Are the tumors fundamentally different genetically, or what's known about that?
Yeah, they're much different. So there's a gene called P53, which is responsible in our cells for repairing damage that comes into our genetic code. And once you stop being able to repair damage in your genetic code, every time your cells divide, they become more and more bizarre and they behave more aggressively, and the cancers are more treatment resistant. And so P53 mutation, so abnormality in that tumor suppressor gene, is the most common abnormality in tobacco-associated head and neck cancer. And it's not present at all in the human papillomavirus-associated cancers.
Oh, how interesting. Why don't we just get drugs that treat the mutant P53 then? That would seem like the way to go.
Yes, and it would also be a great way to get the Nobel Prize. People have been working on that for about 30 years. And there are new indications that there are new strategies for getting at that with WEE1 inhibitors that might be more successful. It's been the holy grail for a long time.
See, every good idea I had, somebody else had it first. That's the story of my professional career. Well, since we can't target the P53 right now, what can we offer that's interesting and new to patients with these harder to cure head and neck cancers?
Yeah. So two things. One is that biologic treatment that I mentioned, cetuximab, does have some activity in the tobacco-associated cancers also. And a big focus of our research has been trying to find out, are there any hallmarks in the cancer cell that predict that they're resistant to those EGFR inhibitors, but that we could still target? And so making combinations of the EGFR inhibitor with another targeted therapy that would shut the whole pathway down. And we've had some early trials that look fairly encouraging with drugs that target an enzyme that's called the Aurora kinase. So that's one thing people are pursuing. Another thing is the thing that's been the big story in oncology the past 2 years, and that is new drugs that manipulate the immune system. And so there's been such an explosion of knowledge of how the immune system is regulated, and these immune cells that are described as exhausted, so they're all lined up in the cancer, but they're not fighting. And new medications which have the ability to reactivate those immune cells. We had a report at the big cancer meeting in Chicago this weekend using one of these drugs in head and neck cancer, and the response rate was about 19%, and some of the responses were very durable. These are easy drugs to use. They don't have a ton of side effects, and so that is certainly going to be an area where clinical trials are going to be available for people with head and neck cancer, and I think it's a very promising avenue.
Well, that's really exciting for that 19%, but that's leaving 80% that are still underserved. How are we going to get there?
Did you
say it was 19, right?
19, yeah. So very interesting. There may be ways to prime the cancers so that we could turn we just started studying this drug this year, but turn something that's a 19% drug into a more active drug. There are also ways of checking the expression of some of the immune markers in the cancer that can select out patients who are more likely to respond. And as has been shown in melanoma, when you combine two or three drugs that have targets in the immune system, but it's not the same target, you can dramatically increase the response rate. So I would look for clinical trials using radiation therapy to prime, using combinations of immunotherapies, and using biomarkers to select out the most sensitive patients.
Wow. And how do people find clinical trials, if they're not being treated, say, by you here at Smilo? Where do people go to look, or how do they even start to negotiate that?
Yeah, I think asking your medical oncologist what clinical trials are open here at your office, or do you know that are available at cancer centers that are nearby? There is a website called clinicaltrials.gov where you can just put in the name of your cancer, and many trials will come up, many, probably that are not that appropriate, and many that are in different parts of the country. But there are a lot of resources if patients want to find clinical trials. And I think for people with head and neck cancer, there's so many new ideas now that it's worth seeking these out.
Dr. Barbara Burtness is a professor of medical oncology and clinical research program leader for the Head and Neck Cancer Program at Yale Cancer Center. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archive programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, as well as Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.